Hi there, I'm Jason McMullen.
And I'm Kate Ariano. Welcome to Words Aloud.
We love books. We love stories, poems, memoirs, narratives, and any kind of written or spoken word that moves us.
That's why we created Words Aloud, a space for us to invite writers of all kinds to share their pieces that we like.
Come get lost in words. You're with friends here.
It's Kate, and I'm back on Words Aloud. This second episode features the brilliant mind behind the first reading on the show, Kat McKenna. Kat is from Massachusetts and is pursuing her MFA at the University of New Hampshire this fall. Today we're tackling a deeper piece of Kat's called Home Cooked. It intertwines true crime tales with the grieving and acceptance of a loss, and the way Kat's descriptions draw you in will leave you feeling curious to know more. So take a listen and stay with us for my post-read interview after Home Cooked.
I know what John Wayne Gacy ate before they led him to the chair, what he got to pick after they found all those boys in the crawl space whose last meals were probably from a vending machine or left on the counter by their mamas for them to heat up later, or a scream swallowed up, tinged with duct tape fibers. Fried shrimp, French fries, a pound of strawberries, and Kentucky Fried Chicken. I wonder how much they spent to give him his last rites. Surely more than a Greyhound ticket, a birthday party clown. When I was little, I was a real picky eater. I didn't like any vegetables besides carrots with ranch dressing, and I only ever ate my pasta plain. It's nights like those that I want to go back to, my body made up of all elbows and knees, curled up next to Mama on the couch, a bowl of buttered noodles in my lap. I started to worry the second day Mama hadn't come home. It was unlike her to miss dinner, let alone two in a row, and it was even stranger that she hadn't called me since Tuesday. She was not like Lindsay's mom, who's always out with some new man and who buys frozen meals in bulk so Lindsay can fend for herself. She wasn't even like Rena's mom, who worked two jobs and who barely saw her kids so that she could feed them. Mama always called, usually multiple times a day. She liked to tell me about her morning, her plans for dinner, whatever celebrity news she caught on the radio that day. I can't remember a time when she didn't call me at least once. I call her again as I bring a pot of water to a boil. At the bottom of my stomach, there's a weight that knows she won't pick up. When I go to voicemail, I'm so worried that I can't eat. My buttered noodles sit on the stovetop until they congeal, the pasta gone chalky as the dairy separates. I never could make them as good as Mama could anyway. I know what Ted Bundy ate after they found all those girls in the woods. The ones whose parents only got a dental match and a condolences. The ones who were punished for daring to be kind, for having the nerve when asked for help to answer yes. Whose last meals were probably from the dining hall, or a hasty breakfast before class, or leftovers from dinner the night before. Steak, eggs, toast with jam and butter, and hash browns. He refused to eat it. I wonder how easy it was for him to refuse that last act of kindness, if he even noticed their attempt at gifting him one last ounce of humanity. Was it as easy as pretending to have a broken arm, asking a pretty brunette for help in carrying his books? Mama started dating Keith a few years back when I was still in school. I never liked him, but I never liked any of her boyfriends. They were always intruders, breaking into our house and ruining everything. They'd put their food in our fridge and their clothes in our hamper, taking up space that we didn't have and that I never agreed to give to them. At night, under my covers, I used to pray and ask God to make them leave, that he would disappear them overnight when Mama was sleeping, and that we'd never see them again. That he would let it be just us forever, no foreign laundry in the wash or some other man's plates in our cupboard. Maybe now I'm being punished for being such a horrible little girl who was selfish and mean and demanded too much from God and her mother. Mama always says I'm selfish, that she has to have a life outside of being Mama where she gets to be Darlene. I know she's right, but I don't think I'm wrong for wanting a better life for her than Keith. Keith asked her out when they both worked at the phone company. He didn't last long after getting caught loaded behind the wheel of a company truck, but somehow Mama forgave him for this after he blamed it on how his daddy used to knock him around when he was a kid. That's what she told me anyway, in a hushed voice in the laundry room after telling me to take it easy on him because he had been through a lot. She's always been too nice, too open to letting losers walk all over her just because they called it love when they held her too tight. I'm not nice, not like Mama. I was an angry kid who grew up into an angry adult. I didn't care if Keith was knocked around, if his daddy was mean. Hell, I wouldn't have cared if his house burned down with him inside and he grew up in the foster home from Little Orphan Annie. All I cared about was that I didn't like how mad he got with my Mama. He never hit her, but I always held my breath waiting for the day that he would. Every screaming match where he got a little too close to her. Every time I heard him tell her to shut up. I used to try and intervene, 14 years old and using up all the air in my lungs to bellow at the man who dared call my Mama a bitch in her own home. Every time, though, Mama would get mad at me. It wasn't my business. It was her relationship. It wasn't my place. I'd run to my room in tears and I'd spiral. I was ruining her relationship. It would be better if I just left. She wished I had never been born so she didn't have a kid to lug around and burden every relationship she ever had. It was my fault we were even in this mess. It was my fault for having been born. Somewhere around year 3 of the cycle repeating itself, I gave up. I stopped cutting in every time his tone got too sharp and I heard his voice rise up from under the floorboards into my bedroom. I stopped hoping every fight was the last, that Mama would finally wake up and realize that Keith was a loser and that she was happier when it was just us, that she would kick him out and apologize for bringing him into our home and granting him my space without asking. I wonder if she'd be answering my calls now if I had kept fighting. I know what Danny Rawlings ate after the papers called him the Gainesville Ripper. After they found those poor college kids whose last meals were probably 99-cent ramen or half off at the grocery store, or maybe nothing at all, so that they could drink for cheap later when they went out with their friends. Lobster tail, butterfly shrimp, a baked potato, strawberry cheesecake, and sweet tea. They say he sang a gospel hymn as he sipped his sweet tea. Was that sugar on his tongue, that song in his ear as he sat in the chair? No, actually, there was no chair. He got one of those new lethal injections. They say it's more humane. The police didn't care that Mama was missing until it had been at least a week since she had last been home. They kept telling me that she was probably busy, that she was with Keith, that she didn't need to check in every day with her daughter who was old enough that she should have already moved out. Leave her alone. She probably just wanted a break. When I called her work and they told me it had been a week since her last clock out, then the cops started to care. It was too late by then. I hadn't seen Keith in as many days as I hadn't seen Mama. I should have known that first night she didn't come home that something terrible had happened, but I was trying to be a good daughter who isn't selfish with her mother's time, one who lets her have a life outside of motherhood. I wish I had been evil and horrible and caught up in my own importance. I wish I had demanded her time that first night. I went to stay with Auntie after the police said they needed to search the house. She made me dinner, something fancier than Mama would have made that had mushrooms and chicken and gravy sauce. It was too salty. I opened my mouth to thank her for the meal when her arms came around my shoulders and my head was buried in the crook of her neck. I realized then that the salt had not been from the food at all, but from the tears coming to rest on my upper lip and fall onto the plate. I loved her so much in that moment, but she still smelled wrong, like mushrooms and perfume and fancy potpourri. I wanted a hug that smelt like sweat underneath Arm & Hammer, Tresemme hairspray and Secret deodorant. I wanted a hug that smelt like Mama. I know what Gerald Stano ate after they found all those girls. Girls whose bodies they keep finding now, even after his was burned in the prison crematorium. There are 33 they know about who could have eaten anything from family dinner to late night fast food. There are up to 88 that could still be out there. Remnants of last meals long gone after years of lonely and quiet decomposition. Delmonico steak. Baked potatoes with sour cream and bacon bits, salad with Roquefort dressing, butter lima beans, mint chocolate chip ice cream, and Coca-Cola. He died proclaiming his innocence. He died saying he was frightened. How many of those girls could say the same thing? How many of them died scared and hungry, no steak and baked potatoes sitting warm in their stomachs, no small comfort to ease them from the terror of a man in a car late at night? Forgive me for having no sympathy for the man in the car. There were search parties and vigils and prayer baskets from churches. Mama's Facebook was covered in posts from old classmates and co-workers, people she met once at a party and never saw again. We were lucky because Mama had been white and she had been pretty. People cared more when people like her went missing. They used the picture of her from my high school graduation on the news, where she was smiling so wide you could see the teeth in the back of her mouth. It was a good picture. I printed it out at the library for a dime to keep with me to show people I saw on the street, and to keep in my wallet like I was the mama and she was my baby. They found her car first. It was three towns over, abandoned in the parking lot of a shuttered Stop and Shop. There was no body in the truck, no obvious blood staining on the seats. It looked just as it always did. If I squinted, I could picture it idled in the driveway. Mama would start it and wave goodbye, and I would hear the twangy crooning of Shania Twain slowly fade as she drove away. The cops did their whole forensic routine. They bagged and tagged and sent samples back to the fancy lab in the city, but I knew before they even told me that there was no trace of her. This was good, they said. There was still hope that she could be alive. To me, it just meant there was more hope for Keith's brain cells, that he had more of a mind than I gave him credit for. It meant that he had planned this, possibly for a long time. It meant that I still didn't know what he did to my mama. Most of her stuff was taken away to dust for prints and to shove into evidence lockers for the next 5 years, forgotten aside from the pretty picture they played on the TV. I don't think they were supposed to let me, but I asked to keep her CDs. It must have been my face, or maybe the detective has a daughter, or maybe he has a mama he loves just as much because he let me take them home. I played myself to sleep that night with Shania. If I closed my eyes just right, I could pretend Mama was just in the driveway. She's only now home from work, and she's sitting in her car to hear the very end of the song. I know what Timothy McVeigh ate after he set off those bombs. After he killed all those people because he thought he had the right to take lives to make a statement. 168. I can't even begin to think what their last meals might have been. 2 pints of mint chocolate chip ice cream. They read Invictus as he died. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. How nice that he got to know how he would die, that he was a master of his fate. I think of the people who died in the name of him captaining his soul. I owe the discovery of my mother's body to the employees of Stan's junkyard. If it had been a day later, she would have been nothing but a pile of dust, of bone fragments crushed up among busted carburetors and old headlights. They found her in a dumpster, one of those ones with a compactor. Someone heard a crunch when they turned it on, and they thought a squirrel or a raccoon had climbed inside. When they saw what it really was, one of them called the police while the other one was too busy vomiting. All for life insurance, because of course that's what this was about. The phone company had good benefits, especially when you've been there for 20 years. $500,000, which Keith had spent years trying to convince Mama to make him a co-beneficiary on. I guess she finally did. Turns out, he was just as stupid as I thought he was. Killed her on the way home from the bank. I guess no one told him that it takes a year to kick in. He was hiding at his Mama's house. She called the cops after they reported that they found the body on the news. Suppose he told her some lie about how Mama kicked him out, and when she finally saw the news report, she admitted to herself that she raised a monster. The teeth still left in her head matched a dental record on file from when Mama got her braces in the 90s. They didn't bring me in to identify any remains because there was nothing left to identify. He had burnt her body. I'm out of energy to keep talking about what men got to eat after they found bodies or bombs or bloodstains in cars. I cannot think of everything that their victims never got to taste again. Sweet tea, steak, their mama's buttered noodles. Was she alive? I asked, when you burned her up. There's a pane of glass that separates me from Keith. I hold the cold metal of the phone to my ear, and I think of how many women have sat here before me, speaking those same words into this same phone. He says nothing. A childhood filled with yelling from beneath my bedroom floor has been reduced to a silent man who even now refuses to grant me the peace I deserve. There's a pane of glass that separates me from Keith, and it's not for my protection. Was she alive? I repeat. Nothing but a set of crossed arms, eyes that won't meet mine. There's a pane of glass that separates me from clenched fist, a throat sore from screaming, the heavy blanket of tense silence, the sharp inhale of a bated breath, one that's anticipating the other shoe to drop. Fine. If you're not going to talk, then you're going to sit there, and for once in your life, you're going to listen to me. Nothing. I'm not sorry, Keith, that your daddy hit you. I'm not sorry that your mama never stepped in and stopped him when he was giving you black eyes before school. That cuff. I'm not sorry that you grew up with no one loving you right. Threw her away. I am sorry, though, that you killed my mama. My mother fed this man. She clothed him. She let him in her bed. I'm sorry I didn't get you out of that house in time. She gave him Christmas presents and made him coupons on his birthday. I'm sorry I didn't save her from you. And despite my best efforts, she loved him. Before you spend the rest of your miserable, wasted life eating ish food and looking over your shoulder to make sure no one pays you back for my mama, just tell me if she was alive when you did it. And he threw her in the trash. Tell me you didn't do that to her, that you loved her just enough to spare her from a death like that. Keith looks at me and I look back. I'm 13 and my chin is jutted out defiantly, lips pursed as I yell at him on Mama's behalf. I'm 15 and I'm crying myself to sleep at the thought that this is forever, that Mama has picked this man over me. I'm 17 and I'm pulling my headphones over my ears to drown out the yelling downstairs. I'm 22 and I'm sitting across from the man who murdered my mother. No, he answers. She was already dead. I know what the man who killed my mama will eat for his last meal. It will be cold in the middle and thawed from frozen in a vat over a decades-old burner. It will taste of nothing unless he drowns it in salt. He will keel over and die over such a meal, heart finally giving out after a life sentence's worth of dry meat and mushy carrots under fluorescent lights. I hope he dies with the ghost of my mother's cooking on his tongue, longing for one last bite of her dinners. I don't know what my mama ate for her last meal. She was a woman who prided herself on under-eating, on making it through a workday on just carrots and yogurt or a lettuce wrap with cheese. I hope she acted out of character on the day that she would die. I hope she treated herself to lunch, a hamburger or pasta with cream sauce or a meatball sub. I hope it tasted good, that it was warm and made her feel full. I can't bear the thought that she might have died hungry.
Hello again, everyone. It's Kate, and we just heard Home Cooked from last week's author, Kat Casey, also known as Kat McKenna, an amazing author, if I do say so myself.
You're too kind.
Kat, you talked last week about your style of writing and the topics that you talk about, one of which is focusing on women and the association with true crime media that women tend to gravitate toward. And I feel like Home Cooked really fits the bill for that kind of content. So what inspired Home Cooked? Was it that association?
It somewhat is. It actually started as a poem, which would have been much different. So I was thinking about the very first thing that came to me was the first few lines, which is, I know what John Wayne Gacy ate when they led him to the chair, da 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 da. And then it was going to be followed by, I don't know what my grandmother ate for her last meal. I don't know what my aunt ate for her last meal. And it was going to be much more personal and not based in fiction and kind of exploring the idea that, you know, why do I know what these men ate after victimizing all of these people? But it's not common for me to know what my loved ones would have had for their last meal. And it's not really common for anybody to know that. So why do we, there's a Wikipedia page labeled last meals from death row. And it just tells you all of the last meals from, you know, famous, and I say famous with an air of disillusion and disgust, serial killers. And so it's why do they get that notoriety? Why do they get that legacy put in place? Mm-hmm.
So going off of that, how do you feel personally about that celebrity and that notoriety that's attached to serial killers and how that may be a motivating factor?
Yeah, because that really is one of the ideas that I was kind of grappling with while writing this, because there shouldn't be We are all human at the end of the day, it's true. But I don't understand why this last kindness is given to people who have never showed it towards other people. And maybe that makes me sound like a monster, but like the fact that last meals have they've actually they've taken away last meals in some certain states. I don't think Texas does a last meal anymore. But the fact that they can request these, you know, huge and extravagant last meals when the people that they killed were not given, a lot of the time we don't even know their names, let alone what they ate before they were, you know, murdered. And so the idea of like notoriety surrounding serial killers, it's really infuriating because you want to, there's a sense of, you know, the macabre where you want to know what happened. It's you know, a real life horror movie. But at the same time, when I'm consuming true crime media, if something is focusing too much on the killer or putting too much notoriety towards the killer, it's something I would turn off. I seek out media that kind of puts more light on the victims and who they were, and that becomes kind of a slippery slope. I've actually kind of fallen out with true crime media lately. My interests are changing, and perhaps what I'm writing about will change too. But the problem is that, and you get these stupid names that they get from the papers. I referenced one of them in my piece, Danny Rollins, who was the Gainesville Ripper. It's actually become a point where when, you know, the FBI or whoever's investigating comes in, has to tell the papers, like, you cannot give these people names because that's just going to give them a greater sense of infamy and notoriety. It's the same idea that, you know, when you consume true crime, obviously you're going to look at also what we're kind of experiencing as our own personal form of true crime these days, rather than the serial killers of the 70s and the 80s has really shifted into more of a focus on mass shootings. That is all focused on notoriety and infamy to the point where they're no longer showing pictures of the people or a lot of the time censoring the names of the people who commit them, so that there's not really a sense of notoriety that's going to be born out of these types of things. I think you see it start with actually timely because the anniversary of it is tomorrow, but you really saw it start with the Columbine shooters. I was going to name them, but that actually kind of negates my point, so I won't. But, you know, they were obsessed with the notoriety that came with serial killers. And then you see out of a lot of the time out of this notoriety, and I'm sorry, I'm really going off on a tangent.
No, please.
But a lot of the time with this notoriety and with situations like that, we're so quick to give excuses to these people. You know, the idea that was propagated for so long that the Columbine shooters were bullied and that they were tortured at school and they were just, you know, this was their breaking point. And it's later been proven that none of that was true. They one of them was just a follower and the other one was a very sick, like, just violent person for the sake of he had those urges, and nobody ever taught him how to control them. And that's not me giving him excuses. That's me saying you were 17 years old. You could have learned how to do that. But we're so quick to empathize with these people. And you see it with the way people talk about how these men were raised. Because, yes, you know what? Ted Bundy did have a very sad childhood. He was abused. But that doesn't excuse anything he did as an adult. You can feel sorry for, you know, little Ted Bundy. But big grown-up Ted Bundy, you know, these women that flocked to the courthouse, because that's another side of that with the idealization of serial killers you saw with Ted Bundy and Richard Ramirez, with women who found them attractive, which couldn't be me. Richard Ramirez famously had horrible breath that, like, rotted his teeth out of his head. Are you joking? That is not... Oh my God.
I don't find that attractive.
No, I wouldn't say.
As a matter of fact,
he lived off candy and Slurpees from the 7-Eleven. And literally, like, that's one of the things that got him caught was how bad his breath was.
Oh my God.
That's embarrassing for him.
Right. Yeah.
And that's the way I like to talk about these men. I think they're all losers. And I try to say that with as much air of giving respect to the people they killed. Because obviously, like, you're not
any less of a person because I think the person that killed you is pathetic.
Right.
I think that that person's pathetic because they felt the need to kill you instead of going to therapy like a normal person, mm-hmm. or at least a well-adjusted person. And I think that's kind of what it boils down to. Because there is the idea you need to talk about it so that it doesn't happen again, but you can't talk about it too much.
Because then it will happen.
You're getting all the copycats who are just... Yeah, which is even more pathetic because at least have an original idea.
So I feel like the way that you've absorbed a lot of true crime material, because even like the facts that you're giving out, I've never heard that this guy got caught partially because his breath was so bad because he thought that the concept of surviving on Slurpees and candy, which in theory sounds kind of fun, wasn't and was a horrible idea and led to his demise, as it should have. But how do you feel as an author writing about these really heavy things?
It is interesting because I don't know if I would be as interested in true crime as I am if I wasn't raised the way I was, because my interest is really born out of my mother's interest, which is very much the, you know, suburban mom watching 48 Hours and being like, don't get in the car with anybody you don't know. Like my
mom. I think that's my mom.
Some of my earliest memories are of cold case episodes that mm-hmm. my mom would have on in the house. And so I don't know how much of it is trying to find a way to write about it. I think it's really when you're writing about crime, especially things that haven't happened to you or people you care about, it is a very dangerous line to walk because it would never, ever be my intention to step on anybody's toes. And that's why, like, with this piece, with Home Cooked, I tried to focus it because you have to, obviously, you don't always relate to the crimes. Actually, I can say I did have a roommate who went on to murder somebody. Yeah, he lived in my basement for a while. Shout out Michael. it was an accident. He did still go to jail, though. The thing about Home Cooked is you have to center it on things you know you can write about because you know them, even if you're dealing with stuff you don't know. So my mom's never gone missing. Mm. I do know people who have gone missing, but nobody in my family-ish has ever gone missing. And so, but I do have a single mom and I was raised by a single mother, and I do have a relationship with my mom, like the one in Home Cooked. And so it's finding these like threads of familiarity to center things that are unfamiliar to you around so that it's still something that is something you can write about. And that's true for anything that you're writing. Because I think there's always an element of you, whether you like it or not, in what you're writing.
Well, Kat, thank you so much for sharing your work again. If people want to find you for your work, where can they find you?
So I will be publishing the physical copy of the Long River Review, which is coming out April 28th. I think there will also be a digital copy available at the Long River Review website. You can find me on Instagram at Catherine, CATHERINE, Maraid, MAIREAD. If you have a problem with it, take it up with my Irish father. And where can they find you, Kate?
They can find me right here at WHUS Radio. And thank you so much again
for
coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. I'd do it again anytime.
Kat, thank you so much again for sharing Home Cooked with us on Words Aloud. If you're interested in hearing more from Kat, take a listen to our first ever episode of the show, where she shared Triple Dog, a teenage thriller, with a suspected killer. And thank you, listeners, for catching some sound waves today on Words Aloud, stories that move you.
If you'd like to submit your work for an appearance on Words Aloud, you can send it to wordsaloudshow@gmail.com. That's WORDSALOUDSHOW @gmail.com. This show is produced with the support of WHUS Radio at the University of Connecticut.